to be Lord of Winterfell and Warden of the North. I require these castles. We have ceded you the Night Fort. Rats and ruins. It's a niggard's gift that costs the giver nothing. Your own man, Yarwick, says it will be half a year before the castle can be made fit for habitation. The other forts are no better. I know that. It makes no matter. They are all we have. There are 19 forts along the wall, and you have men in only 3 of them. I mean to have every one of them garrisoned again before the year is out. I have no quarrel with that, sire, but it is being said that you also mean to grant these castles to your knights and lords, to hold as their own seats, as vassals to your grace. Kings are expected to be open-handed to their followers. Did Lord Eddard teach his bastard nothing? Many of my knights and lords abandon rich lands and start castles in the south. Should their loyalty go unrewarded? If your grace wishes to lose all of my lord father's bannermen, there is no more certain way than by giving northern halls to southern lords. How can I lose men I do not have? I had hoped to bestow Winterfell on a Northman, you may recall, a son of Eddard Stark. He threw my offer in my face. Stannis Baratheon, with a grievance, was like a mastiff with a bone. He gnawed it down to splinters. By right, Winterfell should go to my sister Sansa. Lady Lannister, you mean? You're so eager to see the imp perched on your father's seat. I promise you that will not happen whilst I live, Lord Snow. John knew better than to press the point. Sire, some claim that you mean to grant lands and castles to Rattleshirt and the Magna of Thenn. Who told you that? The talk was all over Castle Black. If you must know, I had the tale from Gilly. Who is Gilly? The wet nurse, said Lady Melisandre. Your grace gave her freedom of the castle. Not for running tales. She's wanted for her teats, not for her tongue. I'll have more milk from her and fewer messages. Castle Black needs no useless mouths, John agreed. I'm sending Gilly south on the next ship out of Eastwatch. Melisandre touched the ruby at her neck. Gilly is giving suck to Dala's son as well as her own. It seems cruel of you to part our little prince from his milk brother, my lord. Careful now, careful. Mother's milk is all they share. Gilly's son is larger and more robust. He kicks the prince and pinches him and shoves him from the breast. Craster was his father, a cruel man and greedy, and blood tells. The king was confused. I thought the wet nurse was this man Craster's daughter.
Wife and daughter both, your grace.
Craster married all his daughters. Gilly's boy was the fruit of their union. Her own father got this child on her. Stannis sounded shocked. You're well rid of her, then. I will not suffer such abominations here. This is not King's Landing.
I can find another wet nurse. If there's none amongst the wildlings, I will send to the mountain clans. Until such time, goat's milk should suffice for the boy, if it please your grace.
Poor fare for a prince, but better than a whore's milk, aye.
Stannis drummed his fingers on the map.
If we may return to the matter of these forts.
Your grace, said John, with chilly courtesy, I have housed your men and fed them, at dire cost to our winter stores. I have clothed them so they would not freeze. Stannis was not appeased.
Aye, you've shared your salt pork and porridge, and you've thrown us some black rags to keep us warm. Rags the wildlings would have taken off your corpses if I had not come north.
John ignored that. I have given you fodder for your horses, and once the stair is done, I will lend you builders to restore the night fort. I've even agreed to allow you to settle wildlings on the gift, which was given to the Night's Watch in perpetuity.
You offer me empty lands and desolations, yet deny me the castles I require to reward my lords and bannermen.
The Night's Watch built those castles, and the Night's Watch abandoned them, to defend the wall. John finished stubbornly. Not as seats for Southron lords. The stones of those forts are mortared with the blood and bones of my brothers long dead. I cannot give them to you. Cannot or will not. The cords in the king's neck stood out sharp as swords. I offered you a name. I have a name, your grace. Snow? Was ever a name more ill-omened? Stannis touched his sword hilt. Just who do you imagine that you are? The watcher on the walls, the sword in the darkness. Don't prate your words at me. Stannis drew the blade he called Lightbringer. Here is your sword in the darkness. Light rippled up and down the blade, now red, now yellow, now orange, painting the king's face in harsh, bright hues. Even a green boy should be able to see that. Are you blind? No, sire, I agree these castles must be garrisoned. Oh, the boy commander agrees. How fortunate. By the night's watch. You do not have the men. Then give me men, sire. I will provide officers for each of the abandoned forts, seasoned commanders who know the wall and the lands beyond and how best to survive the coming winter. In return for all we've given you, grant me the men to fill out the garrisons, men-at-arms, crossbowmen, raw boys. I will even take your wounded and infirm. Stannis stared at him incredulously, then gave a bark of laughter. Hey, you're bold enough, Snow, I grant you that. But you're mad if you think my men will take the black. They can wear any colour cloak they choose, so long as they obey my officers, as they would your own. The king was unmoved. I have knights and lords in my service, scions of noble houses, old in honour. They cannot be expected to serve under poachers, peasants, and murderers. Or bastard, sire? Your own hand is a smuggler. Was a smuggler. I shortened his fingers for that. They tell me that you are the 998th man to command the night's watch, Lord Snow. What do you think the 999th might say about these castles? The sight of your head and the spike might inspire him to be more helpful. The king laid his bright blade down on the map, along the wall, its steel shimmering like sunlight on water. You're only Lord Commander by my sufferance. You would do well to remember that. I'm Lord Commander because my brothers chose me. There were mornings when Jon Snow did not quite believe it himself, when he woke up thinking, surely, this was some mad dream. It's like putting on new clothes, Sam had told him. The fit feels strange at first, but once you've worn them for a while, you get to feeling comfortable. Alistair Thorne complains about the manner of your choosing, and I cannot say he does not have a grievance. The map lay between them like a battleground, drenched by the colours of the glowing sword. The count was done by a blind man with your fat friend by his elbow, and Slint names you a turncloak. And who would know one better than Slint? A turncloak would tell you what you wish to hear and betray you later. Your grace knows that I was fairly chosen. My father always said you were a just man. Just but harsh had been Lord Eddard's exact words, but John did not think it would be wise to share that. Lord Eddard was no friend to me, but he was not without some sense. He would have given me these castles. Oh, never. I cannot speak to what my father might have done. I took an oath, your grace. The wall is mine. For now, we will see how well you hold it. Stannis pointed at him. Keep your ruins, as they mean so much to you. I promise you, though, if any remain empty when the year is out, I will take them, with your leave or without it. And if even one should fall to the foe, your head will soon follow. Now, get out. Lady Melisandre rose from her place near the hearth. With your leave, sire, I will show Lord Snow back to his chambers. Why? He knows the way. Stannis waved them both away. Do what you will. Devon, food, boiled eggs and lemon water. After the warmth of the king's solar, the turnpike stair felt bone-chillingly cold. "Wind's rising, milady," the sergeant warned Melisandre as he handed John back his weapons. "You might want a warmer cloak." "I have my faith to warm me." The red woman walked beside John down the steps. "His grace is growing fond of you."
"I can tell. He only threatened to behead me twice." Melisandre laughed.
"It is his silences you should fear, not his words." As they stepped out into the yard, the wind filled John's cloak and sent it flapping against her. The red priestess brushed the black wool aside and slipped her arm through his. "It may be that you are not wrong about the wilding king. I shall pray for the Lord of Light to send me guidance. When I gaze into the flames, I can see through stone and earth and find the truth within men's souls. I can speak to kings long dead and children not yet born, and watch the years and seasons flicker past until the end of days."
"Are your fires never wrong?"
"Never. Though we priests are mortal, and sometimes err, mistaking this must come for this may come."
John could feel her heat, even through his wool and boiled leather. The sight of them arm in arm was drawing curious looks.
"Oh, they will be whispering in the barracks tonight. If you can truly see the morrow in your flames, tell me when and where the next wiling attack will come." He slipped his arm free.
"Lore sends us what visions he will, but I shall seek for this man Tormund in the flames."
Melisandre's red lips curled into a smile.
"I have seen you in my fires, Jon Snow."
"Is that a threat, my lady? Do you mean to burn me too?"
"You mistake my meaning."
She gave him a searching look.
"I fear that I make you uneasy, Lord Snow."
Jon did not deny it. "The wall is no place for a woman."
"Oh, you're wrong. I have dreamed of your wall, Jon Snow. Great was the lore that raised it, and great the spells locked beneath its ice. We walk beneath one of the hinges of the world."
Melisandre gazed up at it, her breath a warm, moist cloud in the air.
"This is my place, as it is yours, and soon enough you may have grave need of me. Do not refuse my friendship, John. I have seen you in the storm, hard-pressed, with enemies on every side. You have so many enemies. Shall I tell you their names?"
"I know their names."
"Do not be so certain."
The ruby at Melisandre's throat gleamed redly.
"It is not the foes who curse you to your face that you must fear, but those who smile when you are looking and sharpen their knives when you turn your back. You would do well to keep your wolf close beside you. Ice, I see, and daggers in the dark, blood frozen red and hard, and naked steel. It was very cold."
"It is always cold on the wall."
"You think so?"
"I know so, my lady."
"Then you know nothing, Jon Snow," she whispered.
The first day of the tourney dawned bright and clear. Dunk bought a sack full of foodstuffs, so they were able to break their fast on goose eggs, fried bread, and bacon. But when the food was cooked, he found he had no appetite. His belly felt hard as a rock, even though he knew he would not ride today. The rite of first challenge would go to knights of higher birth and greater renown, to lords and their sons and champions from other tourneys. Egg chattered all through their breakfast, talking of this man and that man and how they might fare. "He was not japing me when he said he knew every good knight in the Seven Kingdoms," Dunk thought ruefully. He found it humbling to listen so intently to the words of a scrawny orphan boy, but Egg's knowledge might serve him should he face one of these men in a tilt. The meadow was a churning mass of people, all trying to elbow their way closer for a better view. Dunk was as good an elbower as any, and bigger than most. He squirmed forward to a rise 6 yards from the fence. When Egg complained that all he could see were asses, Dunk sat the boy on his shoulders. Across the field, the viewing stand was filling up with highborn lords and ladies, a few rich townfolk, and a score of knights who had decided not to compete today. Of Prince Makar, he saw no sign, but he recognized Prince Baelor at Lord Ashford's side. Sunlight flashed golden off the shoulder clasp that held his cloak and the slim coronet about his temples. But otherwise, he dressed far more simply than most of the other lords. "He does not look like a Targaryen in truth, with that dark hair," Dunk said as much to Egg. "It said he favors his mother," the boy reminded him. "She was a Dornish princess." The five champions had raised their pavilions at the north end of the lists, with the river behind them. The smallest two were orange, and the shields hung outside their doors displayed the white sun and chevron. Those would be Lord Ashford's sons, Andro and Robert, brothers to the fair maid. Dunk had never heard other knights speak of their prowess, which meant they would likely be the first to fall. Beside the orange pavilions stood one of deep-dyed green, much larger. The golden rose of Highgarden flapped above it, and the same device was emblazoned on the great green shield outside the door.
"That's Leo Tyrell, Lord of Highgarden," said Egg.
"I knew that," said Dunk, irritated.
"The old man and I served at Highgarden before you were ever born."
He hardly remembered that year himself, but Sir Arlen had often spoken of Leo Longthorn, as he was sometimes called, a peerless jouster, for all the silver in his hair.
"That must be Lord Leo beside the tent, the slender greybeard in green and gold."
"Yes," said Egg. "I saw him at King's Landing once. He's not one you'll want to challenge, sir."
"Boy, I do not require your counsel on who to challenge."
The fourth pavilion was sewn together from diamond-shaped pieces of cloth, alternating red and white. Dunk did not know the colors, but Egg said they belonged to a knight from the Vale of Arryn named Sir Humphrey Harding.
"He won a great melee at Maidenpool last year, sir, and overthrew Sir Donal of Duskendale and the Lords Arryn and Royce on the lists."
The last pavilion was Prince Velar's. Of black silk it was, with a line of pointed scarlet pennons hanging from its roof like long red flames. The shield on its stand was glossy black, emblazoned with the three-headed dragon of House Targaryen. One of the Kingsguard knights stood beside it, his shining white armor stark against the black of the tent cloth. Seeing him there, Dunk wondered whether any of the challengers would dare to touch the dragon shield. Velar was the king's grandson, after all, and son to Baelor Breakspear. He need not have worried. When the horns blew to summon the challengers, all five of the maid's champions were called forth to defend her. Dunk could hear the murmur of excitement in the crowd as the challengers appeared, one by one, at the south end of the lists. Heralds boomed out the name of each knight in turn. They paused before the viewing stand to dip their lances in salute to Lord Ashford, Prince Baelor, and the fair maid, then circled to the north end of the field to select their opponents. The Grey Lion of Casterly Rock struck the shield of Lord Tyrell, while his golden-haired heir, Sir Tybalt Lannister, challenged Lord Ashford's eldest son. Lord Tully of River Run tapped the diamond-patterned shield of Sir Humphrey Harding. Sir Abelard Hightower knocked upon Velar's, and the younger Ashford was called out by Sir Lionel Baratheon, the young knight they called the Laughing Storm. The challengers trotted back to the south end of the lists to await their foes. Sir Abelard in silver and smoke colors, a stone watchtower on his shield, crowned with fire. The two Lannisters all crimson, bearing the golden lion of Casterly Rock. The Laughing Storm shining in cloth of gold, with a black stag on breast and shield and a rack of iron antlers on his helm. Lord Tully wearing a striped blue and red cloak, clasped with a silver trout at each shoulder. They pointed their 12-foot lances skyward, the gusty wind snapping and tugging at the pennons. At the north end of the field, squires held brightly barded destriers for the champions to mount. They donned their helms and took up lance and shield in splendor the equal of their foes, the Ashfords' billowing orange silks, Sir Humphrey's red and white diamonds, Lord Leo on his white charger with green satin trappings patterned with golden roses, and of course, Valar Targaryen. The young prince's horse was black as night, to match the color of his armor, lance, shield, and trappings. Atop his helm was a gleaming three-headed dragon, wings spread, enameled in a rich red. Its twin was painted upon the glossy black surface of his shield. Each of the defenders had a wisp of orange silk knotted about an arm, a favor bestowed by the fair maid. As the champions trotted into position, Ashford Meadow grew almost still. Then a horn sounded, and stillness turned to tumult in half a heartbeat. 10 pairs of gilded spurs drove into the flanks of 10 great war horses. 1,000 voices began to scream and shout. 40 iron-shod hooves pounded and tore the grass. 10 lances dipped and steadied. The field seemed almost to shake, and champions and challengers came together in a rending crash of wood and steel. In an instant, the riders were beyond each other, wheeling about for another pass. Lord Tully reeled in his saddle, but managed to keep his seat. When the commons realized that all 10 of the lances had broken, the great roar of approval went up. It was a splendid omen for the success of the tourney, and a testament to the skill of the competitors. Squires handed fresh lances to the jousters to replace the broken ones they cast aside, and once more the spurs dug deep. Dunk could feel the earth trembling beneath the soles of his feet. Atop his shoulders, Egg shouted happily and waved his pipe-stem arms. The young prince passed nearest to them. Dunk saw the point of his black lance kiss the watchtower on his foe's shield and slide off to slam into his chest, even as Sir Abelard's own lance burst into splinters against Valar's breastplate. The gray stallion in the silver and smoke trappings reared with the force of the impact, and Sir Abelard Hightower was lifted from his stirrups and dashed violently to the ground. Lord Tully was down as well, unhorsed by Sir Humphrey Harding, but he sprang up at once and drew his longsword, and Sir Humphrey cast aside his lance, unbroken, and dismounted to continue their fight afoot. Sir Abelard was not so sprightly. His squire ran out, loosened his helm, and called for help, and 2 serving men lifted the dazed knight by the arms to help him back to his pavilion. Elsewhere on the field, the 6 knights who had remained a horse were riding their 3rd course. More lances shattered, and this time Lord Leo Tyrell aimed his point so expertly he ripped the gray lion's helm cleanly off his head. Barefaced, the Lord of Casterly Rock raised his hand in salute and dismounted, yielding the match. By then, Sir Humphrey had beaten Lord Tully into surrender, showing himself as skilled with a sword as he was with a lance. Tybalt Lannister and Andro Ashford rode against each other thrice more before Sir Andro finally lost shield, seat, and match all at once. The younger Ashford lasted even longer, breaking no less than 9 lances against Sir Lionel Baratheon, the Laughing Storm. Champion and challenger both lost their saddles on their 10th course, only to rise together to fight on, sword against mace. Finally, a battered Sir Robert Ashford admitted defeat, but on the viewing stand his father looked anything but dejected. Both Lord Ashford's sons had been ushered from the ranks of the champions, it was true, but they had acquitted themselves nobly against 2 of the finest knights in the 7 kingdoms.
"I must do even better, though," Dunk thought as he watched victor and vanquished embrace and walk together from the field. "It is not enough for me to fight well and lose. I must win at least the first challenge, or I lose all."
Sir Tybalt Lannister and the Laughing Storm would now take their places among the champions, replacing the men they had defeated. Already the orange pavilions were coming down. A few feet away, the young prince sat at his ease in a raised camp chair before his great black tent. His helm was off. He had dark hair like his father, but a bright streak ran through it. A serving man brought him a silver goblet, and he took a sip.
"Water, if he is wise," Dunk thought. "Wine, if not."
He found himself wondering if Valar had indeed inherited a measure of his father's prowess, or whether it had only been that he had drawn the weakest opponent. A fanfare of trumpets announced that three new challengers had entered the lists. The heralds shouted their names.
Sir Perce of House Caron, Lord of the Marches.
He had a silver harp emblazoned on his shield, though his surcoat was patterned with nightingales.
Sir Joseph of House Malister from Seaguard.
Sir Joseph sported a winged helm. On his shield, a silver eagle flew across an indigo sky.
Sir Gawain of House Swan, Lord of Stonehelm on the Cape of Wrath.
A pair of swans, one black and one white, fought furiously on his arms. Lord Gawain's armor, cloak, and horse bardings were a riot of black and white as well, down to the stripes on his scabbard and lance. Lord Caron, harper and singer and knight of renown, touched the point of his lance to Lord Tyrell's rose. Sir Joseph thumped on Sir Humphrey Harding's diamonds, and the black and white knight, Lord Gawain Swan, challenged the Black Prince with the White Guardian. Dunk rubbed his chin. Lord Gawain was even older than the old man, and the old man was dead.
Egg, who is the least dangerous of these challengers?
He asked the boy on his shoulders, who seemed to know so much of these knights.
Lord Gawain,
the boy said at once.
Valar's foe.
Prince Valar, he corrected. A squire must keep a courteous tongue, boy.
The three challengers took their places as the three champions mounted up. Men were making wagers all around them and calling out encouragement to their choices, but Dunk had eyes only for the prince. On the first pass, he struck Lord Gawain's shield a glancing blow, the blunted point of the lance sliding aside just as it had with Sir Abelard Hightower, only this time it was deflected the other way, into empty air. Lord Gawain's own lance broke clean against the prince's chest, and Valar seemed about to fall for an instant before he recovered his seat. The second time through the lists, Valar swung his lance left, aiming for his foe's breast, but struck his shoulder instead. Even so, the blow was enough to make the older knight lose his lance. One arm flailed for balance, and Lord Gawain fell. The young prince swung from the saddle and drew his sword, but the fallen man waved him off and raised his visor.
I yield, your grace, he called. Well fought.
The lords in the viewing stand echoed him, shouting,
well fought, well fought,
as Valar knelt to help the gray-haired lord to his feet.
It was not either,
Egg complained.
Be quiet, or you can go back to camp.
Farther away, Sir Joseph Malister was being carried off the field unconscious, while the Harp Lord and the Rose Lord were going at each other lustily with blunted long axes, to the delight of the roaring crowd. Dunk was so intent on Valar Targaryen that he scarcely saw them.
He is a fair knight, but no more than that, he found himself thinking. I would have a chance against him. If the gods were good, I might even unhorse him, and once afoot my weight and strength would tell. Get him!
Egg shouted merrily, shifting his seat on Dunk's back in his excitement.
Get him! Hit him! Yes! He's right there! He's right there!
It seemed to be Lord Caron he was cheering on. The harper was playing a different sort of music now, driving Lord Leo back and back as steel sang on steel. The crowd seemed almost equally divided between them, so cheers and curses mingled freely in the morning air. Chips of wood and paint were flying from Lord Leo's shield as Lord Perce's axe knocked the petals off his golden rose, one by one, until the shield finally shattered and split. But as it did, the axe head hung up for an instant in the wood, and Lord Leo's own axe crashed down on the haft of his foe's weapon, breaking it off not a foot from his hand. He cast aside his broken shield, and suddenly he was the one on the attack. Within moments, the harbor knight was on one knee, singing his surrender. For the rest of the morning and well into the afternoon, it was more of the same, as challengers took the field in twos and threes and sometimes five together. Trumpets blew, the heralds called out names, war horses charged, the crowds cheered, lances snapped like twigs, and swords rang against helms and mail. It was, small folk and high lord alike agreed, a splendid day of jousting. Sir Humphrey Harding and Sir Humphrey Beesbury, a bold young knight in yellow and black stripes with three beehives on his shield, splintered no less than a dozen lances apiece in an epic struggle the small folk soon began calling the Battle of Humphrey. Sir Tybalt Lannister was unhorsed by Sir John Penrose and broke his sword in his fall, but fought back with shield alone to win the bout and remain a champion. One-eyed Sir Robin Risling, a grizzled old knight with a salt-and-pepper beard, lost his helm to Lord Leo's lance in their first course, yet refused to yield. Three times more they rode at each other, the wind whipping Sir Robin's hair while the shards of broken lances flew round his bare face like wooden knives, which Dunk thought all the more wondrous when Egg told him that Sir Robin had lost his eye to a splinter from a broken lance not 5 years earlier. Leo Tyrell was too chivalrous to aim another lance at Sir Robin's unprotected head, but even so, Risling's stubborn courage, or was it folly, left Dunk astounded. Finally, the Lord of Highgarden struck Sir Robin's breastplate a solid thump right over the heart and sent him cartwheeling to the earth. Sir Lionel Baratheon also fought several notable matches. Against lesser foes, he would often break into booming laughter the moment they touched his shield, and laugh all the time he was mounting and charging and knocking them from their stirrups. If his challengers wore any sort of crest on their helm, Sir Lionel would strike it off and fling it into the crowd. The crests were ornate things, made of carved wood or shaped leather, and sometimes gilded and enameled, or even wrought in pure silver, so the men he beat did not appreciate this habit, though it made him a great favorite of the commons. Before long, only crestless men were choosing him. As loud and often as Sir Lionel laughed down a challenger, though, Dunk thought the day's honors should go to Sir Humphrey Harding, who humbled 14 knights, each one of them formidable. Meanwhile, the young prince sat outside his black pavilion, drinking from his silver goblet and rising from time to time to mount his horse and vanquish yet another undistinguished foe. He had won 9 victories, but it seemed to Dunk that every one was hollow.
"He's beating old men and up-jumped squires, and a few lords of high birth and low skill. The truly dangerous men are riding past his shield as if they do not see it."
Late in the day, a brazen fanfare announced the entry of a new challenger to the lists. He rode in on a great red charger, whose black bardings were slashed to reveal glimpses of yellow, crimson, and orange beneath. As he approached the viewing stand to make his salute, Dunk saw the face beneath the raised visor and recognized the prince he'd met in Lord Ashford's stables. Egg's legs tightened around his neck.
"Stop that," Dunk snapped, yanking them apart. "Do you mean to choke me?"
"Prince Arian Brightflame," a herald called. "Of the Red Keep of King's Landing, son of Maekar, Prince of Summerhall of House Targaryen, grandson to Daeron the Good, the second of his name, King of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the first man and Lord of the Seven Kingdoms."
Arian bore a three-headed dragon on his shield, but it was rendered in colors much more vivid than Valar's. One head was orange, one yellow, one red, and the flames they breathed had the sheen of gold leaf. His surcoat was a swirl of smoke and fire woven together, and his blackened helm was surmounted by a crest of red enamel flames. After a pause to dip his lance to Prince Baylor, a pause so brief that it was almost perfunctory, he galloped to the north end of the field, past Lord Leo's pavilion and the laughing storms, slowing only when he approached Prince Valar's tent. The young prince rose and stood stiffly beside his shield, and for a moment, Dunk was certain that Arian meant to strike it. But then he laughed and trotted past, and banged his point hard against Sir Humphrey Harding's diamonds.
Come out, little knight," he sang in a loud, clear voice. "It's time you faced the dragon."
Sir Humphrey inclined his head stiffly to his foe as his destrier was brought out, and then ignored him while he mounted, fastened his helm, and took up lance and shield. The spectators grew quiet as the two knights took their places. Dunk heard the clang of Prince Arion dropping his visor. The horn blew. Sir Humphrey broke slowly, building speed, but his foe raked the red charger hard with both spurs, coming hard. Egg's legs tightened again.
"Kill him!"
he shouted suddenly.
"Kill him! He's right there! Kill him! Kill him! Kill him!"
Dunk was not certain which of the knights he was shouting to. Prince Arion's lance, gold-tipped and painted in stripes of red, orange, and yellow, swung down across the barrier.
"Low, too low," thought Dunk the moment he saw it. "He'll miss the rider and strike Sir Humphrey's horse. He needs to bring it up."
Then, with dawning horror, he began to suspect that Arion intended no such thing.
"He cannot mean to."
At the last possible instant, Sir Humphrey's stallion reared away from the oncoming point, eyes rolling in terror, but too late. Arion's lance took the animal just above the armor that protected his breastbone and exploded out of the back of his neck in a gout of bright blood. Screaming, the horse crashed sideways, knocking the wooden barrier to pieces as he fell. Sir Humphrey tried to leap free, but a foot caught in a stirrup, and they heard his shriek as his leg was crushed between the splintered fence and falling horse. All of Ashford Meadow was shouting. Men ran onto the field to extricate Sir Humphrey, but the stallion, dying in agony, kicked at them as they approached. Arion, having raced blithely around the carnage to the end of the lists, wheeled his horse and came galloping back. He was shouting too, though Dunk could not make out the words over the almost human screams of the dying horse. Vaulting from the saddle, Arion drew his sword and advanced on his fallen foe. His own squires and one of Sir Humphrey's had to pull him back. Egg squirmed on Dunk's shoulders.
"Let me down," the boy said. "The poor horse, let me down."
Dunk felt sick himself. What would I do if such a fate befell Thunder? A man-at-arms with pole-axe dispatched Sir Humphrey's stallion, ending the hideous screams. Dunk turned and forced his way through the press. When he came to open ground, he lifted Egg off his shoulders. The boy's hood had fallen back and his eyes were red.
"A terrible sight, aye," he told the lad. "But a squire must needs be strong. You'll see worse mishaps at other tourneys, I fear." "It was no mishap," Egg said, mouth trembling. "Arion meant to do it, you saw."
Dunk frowned. It had looked that way to him as well. But it was hard to accept that any knight could be so unchivalrous, least of all one who was blood of the dragon.
"I saw a knight, green as summer grass, lose control of his lance," he said stubbornly. "And I'll hear no more of it. The jousting is done for the day, I think. Come, lad."
The next day proved the truth of Ser Kyle's prophecy. Ned's ferry was no wise large enough to accommodate all those who wished to cross, so Lords Costain and Shawnee must go first with their tales. That required several trips, each taking more than an hour. There were the mudflats to contend with, horses and wagons to be gotten down the planks, loaded on the boat, and unloaded again across the lake. The two lords slowed matters even further when they got into a shouting match over precedence. Shawnee was the elder, but Costain held himself to be better born. There was naught that Dunk could do but wait and swelter. "We could go first if you let me use my boot," Egg said.
"We could," Dunk answered, "but we won't. Lord Costain and Lord Shawnee were here before us. Besides, they're lords."
Egg made a face. "Rebel lords." Dunk frowned down at him.
"What do you mean?"
"They were for the Black Dragon. Well, Lord Shawnee was, and Lord Costain's father. Aemon and I used to fight the battle on Maester Meliquin's green table with painted soldiers and little banners. Costain's arms quarter a silver chalice on black with a black rose on gold. That banner was on the left of Daemon's host. Shawnee was with Bittersteel on the right and almost died of his wounds."
"Old dead history. They're here now, aren't they? So they bent the knee and King Daeron gave them pardon."
"Yes, but..." Dunk pinched the boy's lips shut.
"Hold your tongue."
Egg held his tongue. No sooner had the last boatload of Shawnee men pushed off than Lord and Lady Smallwood turned up at the landing with their own tale, so they must needs wait again. The Fellowship of the Hedge had not survived the night, it was plain to see. Sir Glendon kept his own company, prickly and sullen. Kyle the Cat judged that it would be midday before they were allowed to board the ferry, so he detached himself from the others to try to ingratiate himself with Lord Smallwood, with whom he had some slight acquaintance. Sir Maynard spent his time gossiping with the innkeep. "Stay well away from that one," Dunk warned Egg. There was something about Plum that troubled him. He could be a robber knight, for all we know. The warning only seemed to make Sir Maynard more interesting to Egg.
"I never knew a robber knight. Do you think he means to rob the dragon's egg?"
"Lord Butterwell will have the egg well guarded, I'm sure." Dunk scratched the midge bites on his neck. "Do you think he might display it at the feast? I'd like to get a look at one."
"I'd show you mine, sir, but it's at Summer Hall."
"Yours? Your dragon's egg?" Dunk frowned down at the boy, wondering if this was some jape. "Where did it come from?"
"From a dragon, sir. They put it in my cradle."
"Do you want a clout in the ear? There are no dragons."
"No, but there are eggs. The last dragon left a clutch of 5, and they have more on Dragonstone, old ones from before the dance. My brothers all have them, too. Arion's looks as though it's made of gold and silver, with veins of fire running through it. Mine is white and green, all swirly."
"Your dragon's egg." They put it in his cradle. Dunk was so used to Egg that sometimes he forgot Aegon was a prince. Of course they'd put a dragon egg inside his cradle. "Well, see that you don't go mentioning this egg where anyone is like to hear."
"I'm not stupid, sir." Egg lowered his voice. "Someday the dragons will return. My brother Daeron's dreamed of it, and King Ares read it in a prophecy. Maybe it will be my egg that hatches. That would be splendid."
"Would it?" Dunk had his doubts. "Not Egg."
"Aemon and I used to pretend that our eggs would be the ones to hatch. If they did, we could fly through the sky on dragonback like the first Aegon and his sisters."
"Aye, and if all the other knights in the realm should die, I'd be the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard. If these eggs are so bloody precious, why is Lord Butterwell giving his away?"
"To show the realm how rich he is?"
"I suppose." Dunk scratched his neck again and glanced over at Sir Glendon Ball, who was tightening the cinches on his saddle as he waited for the ferry. "That horse will never serve." Sir Glendon's mount was a sway-backed stot, undersized and old. "What do you know about his sire? Why did they call him Fireball?"
"For his hot head and red hair. Sir Quentin Ball was the master-at-arms at the Red Keep. He taught my father and my uncles how to fight. The great bastards, too. King Aegon promised to raise him to the King's Guard, so Fireball made his wife join the Silent Sisters. Only by the time a place came open, King Aegon was dead and King Daeron named Sir William Wilde instead. My father says that it was Fireball as much as Bittersteel who convinced Daemon Blackfyre to claim the crown and rescued him when Daeron sent the Kingsguard to arrest him. Later on, Fireball killed Lord Lefford at the gates of Lannisport and sent the Grey Lion running back to hide inside the rock. At the crossing of the Mander, he cut down the sons of Lady Penrose one by one. They say he spared the life of the youngest one as a kindness to his mother."
"That was chivalrous of him," Dunk had to admit. "Did Sir Quentin die upon the red grass field?"
"Before, sir," Egg replied. "An archer put an arrow through his throat as he dismounted by a stream to have a drink. Just some common man, no one knows who."
"Those common men can be dangerous when they get it in their heads to start slaying lords and heroes." Dunk saw the ferry creeping slowly across the lake. "Here it comes."
"It's slow. Are we going to go to White Walls, sir?"
"Why not? I want to see this dragon's egg." Dunk smiled.
If I win the tourney, we'd both have dragon's eggs. Egg gave him a doubtful look. What? Why are you looking at me that way?
I could tell you, sir, the boy said solemnly, but I need to learn to hold my tongue.
They seated the hedge knights well below the salt, closer to the doors than to the dais. White Walls was almost new as castles went, having been raised a mere 40 years ago by the grandsire of its present lord. The small folk hereabouts called it the Milk House, for its walls and keeps and towers were made of finely dressed white stone, quarried in the vale and brought over the mountains at great expense. Inside were floors and pillars of milky white marble veined with gold. The rafters overhead were carved from the bone-pale trunks of weirwoods. Dunk could not begin to imagine what all of that had cost. The hall was not so large as some others he had known, though. At least we were allowed beneath the roof, Dunk thought as he took his place on the bench between Sir Maynard Plum and Kyle the Cat. Though uninvited, the three of them had been welcomed to the feast quick enough. It was ill luck to refuse a knight hospitality on your wedding day. Young Sir Glendon had a harder time, however.
Fireball never had a son,
Dunk heard Lord Butterwell's steward tell him loudly. The stripling answered heatedly, and the name of Sir Morgan Dunstable was mentioned several times, but the steward had remained adamant. When Sir Glendon touched his sword hilt, a dozen men-at-arms appeared with spears in hand, but for a moment it looked as though there might be bloodshed. It was only the intervention of a big blonde knight named Kirby Pym that saved the situation. Dunk was too far away to hear, but he saw Pym clasp an arm around the steward's shoulders and murmur in his ear, laughing. The steward frowned and said something to Sir Glendon that turned the boy's face dark red. He looks as if he's about to cry, Dunk thought, watching. That or kill someone. After all of that, the young knight was finally admitted to the castle hall. Poor Egg was not so fortunate.
The great hall is for the lords and knights, an understeward had informed them haughtily when Dunk tried to bring the boy inside. We have set up tables in the inner yard for squires, grooms, and men-at-arms.
If you had an inkling who he was, you would seat him on the dais on a cushioned throne. Dunk had not much liked the look of the other squires. A few were lads of Egg's own age, but most were older, seasoned fighters who long ago had made the choice to serve a knight rather than become one. Or did they have a choice? Knighthood required more than chivalry and skill at arms. It required horse and sword and armor, too, and all of that was costly. Watch your tongue, he told Egg before he left him in that company. These are grown men. They won't take kindly to your insolence. Sit and eat and listen. Might be you'll learn some things. For his own part, Dunk was just glad to be out of the hot sun, with a wine cup before him and a chance to fill his belly. Even a hedge knight grows weary of chewing every bite of food for half an hour. Down here, below the salt, the fare would be more plain than fancy, but there would be no lack of it. Below the salt was good enough for Dunk. But peasant's pride is lordling's shame, the old man used to say.
This cannot be my proper place, Sir Glendon Ball told the understeward hotly.
He had donned a clean doublet for the feast, a handsome old garment with gold lace at the cuffs and collar, and the red chevron and white plates of House Ball sewn across the chest.
Do you know who my father was?
A noble knight and mighty lord, I have no doubt, said the understeward, but the same is true of many here. Please, take your seat or take your leave, sir. It's all the same to me.
In the end, the boy took his place below the salt with the rest of them, his mouth sullen. The long white hall was filling up as more knights crowded onto the benches. The crowd was larger than Dunk had anticipated, and from the looks of it,
some of the guests had come a very long way. He and Egg had not been around so many lords and knights since Ashford Meadow, and there was no way to guess who else might turn up next. "We should have stayed out in the hedges, sleeping under trees, if I am recognized." When a serving man placed a loaf of black bread on the cloth in front of each of them, Dunk was grateful for the distraction. He sawed the loaf open lengthwise, hollowed out the bottom half for a trencher, and ate the top. It was stale, but compared with his salt beef, it was custard. At least it did not have to be soaked in ale or milk or water to make it soft enough to chew.
"Sir Duncan, you appear to be attracting a deal of attention," Sir Maynard Plum observed as Lord Virwell and his party went parading past them toward places of high honor at the top of the hall. "Those girls up on the dais cannot seem to take their eyes off you. I'll wager they have never seen a man so big. Even seated, you are half a head taller than any man in the hall." Dunk hunched his shoulders. He was used to being stared at, but that did not mean he liked it.
"Let them look."
"That's the old ox down there beneath the dais," Sir Maynard said. "They call him a huge man, but seems to me his belly is the biggest thing about him. You're a bloody giant next to him."
"Indeed, sir," said one of their companions on the bench, a sallow man, saturnine, clad in gray and green. His eyes were small and shrewd, set close together beneath thin, arching brows. A neat black beard framed his mouth to make up for his receding hair. "In such a field as these, your size alone should make you one of the most formidable competitors."
"I had heard the brute of Bracken might be coming," said another man farther down the bench.
"I think not," said the man in green and gray. "This is only a bit of jousting to celebrate his lordship's nuptials. A tilt in the yard to mark the tilt between the sheets. Hardly worth the bother for the likes of Otho Bracken."
Sir Kyle the Cat took a drink of wine.
"I'll wager my Lord of Butterwell does not take the field either. He will cheer on his champions from his lord's box in the shade."
"Then he'll see his champions fall," boasted Sir Glendon Ball, "and in the end he'll hand his egg to me."
"Sir Glendon is the son of Fireball," Sir Kyle explained to the new man. "Might we have the honor of your name, sir?"
"Sir Uthor Underleaf, the son of no one of importance."
Underleaf's garments were of good cloth, clean and well cared for, but simply cut. A silver clasp in the shape of a snail fastened his cloak.
"If your lance is the equal of your tongue, Sir Glendon, you may even give this big fellow here a contest."
Sir Glendon glanced at Dunk as the wine was being poured.
"If we meet, he'll fall. I don't care how big he is."
Dunk watched a server fill his wine cup.
"I am better with a sword than with a lance," he admitted, "and even better with a battle axe. Will there be a melee here?"
His size and strength would stand him in good stead in a melee, and he knew he could give as good as he got. Jousting was another matter.
"Melee at a marriage?" Sir Kyle sounded shocked. "That would be unseemly."
Sir Maynard gave a chuckle.
"A marriage is a melee, as any married man could tell you."
Sir Uthor chuckled.
"There's just the joust, I fear. But besides the dragon's egg, Lord Butterwell has promised 30 golden dragons for the loser of the final tilt, and 10 each for the knights defeated in the round before."
10 dragons is not so bad. 10 dragons would buy a palfrey, so Dunk would not need to ride thunder save in battle. 10 dragons would buy a suit of plate for Egg, and a proper knight's pavilion sewn with Dunk's tree and falling star. 10 dragons would mean roast goose and ham and pigeon pie.
"There are ransoms to be had as well for those who win their matches," Sir Uthor said as he hollowed out his trencher, "and I have heard it rumored that some men place wagers on the tilts. Lord Butterwell himself is not fond of taking risks, but amongst his guests are some who wager heavily. No sooner had he spoken than Ambrose Butterwell made his entrance to a fanfare of trumpets from the minstrels' gallery. Dunk shoved to his feet with the rest as Butterwell escorted his new bride down a patterned mirrorish carpet to the dais, arm in arm. The girl was 15 and freshly flowered, her lord husband 50 and freshly widowed. She was pink and he was gray. Her bride's cloak trailed behind her, done in undy green and white and yellow. It looked so hot and heavy that Dunk wondered how she could bear to wear it. Lord Butterwell looked hot and heavy, too, with his heavy jowls and thinning flaxen hair. The bride's father followed close behind her, hand in hand with his young son. Lord Frey of the Crossing was a lean man, elegant in blue and gray. His heir, a chinless boy of four, whose nose was dripping snot. Lords Costain and Risley came next, with their lady wives, daughters of Lord Butterwell by his first wife. Frey's daughters followed with their own husbands. Then came Lord Gorman Peake, Lords Smallwood and Shawnee, various lesser lords and landed knights. Amongst them, Dunk glimpsed John the Fiddler and Alan Cockshaw. Lord Alan looked to be in his cups, though the feast had not yet properly begun. By the time all of them had sauntered to the dais, the high table was as crowded as the benches. Lord Butterwell and his bride sat on plump, downy cushions in a double throne of gilded oak. The rest planted themselves in tall chairs with fancifully carved arms. On the wall behind them, two huge banners hung from the rafters, the twin towers of Frey, blue on gray, and the green and white and yellow undie of the Butterwells. It fell to Lord Frey to lead the toasts. "The king," he began simply. Sir Glendon held his wine cup out above the water basin. Dunk clanked his cup against it, and against Sir Uthor's and the rest as well. They drank. "Lord Butterwell, our gracious host," Frey proclaimed next. "May the Father grant him long life and many sons." They drank again. "Lady Butterwell, the maiden bride, my darling daughter, may the mother make her fertile." Frey gave the girl a smile. "I shall want a grandson before the year is out. Twins would suit me even better, so—" "Churn the butter well tonight, my sweet." Laughter rang against the rafters, and the guests drank still once more. The wine was rich and red and sweet. Then Lord Frey said, "I give you the king's hand, Brynden Rivers. May the crone's lamp light his path to wisdom." He lifted his goblet high and drank, together with Lord Butterwell and his bride and the others on the dais. Below the salt, Sir Glendon turned his cup over to spill its contents to the floor.
"A sad waste of good wine," said Maynard Plum.
"I do not drink to kinslayers," said Sir Glendon. "Lord Bloodraven is a sorcerer and a bastard."
"Born bastard," Sir Uthor agreed mildly, "but his royal father made him legitimate as he lay dying."
He drank deep, as did Sir Maynard and many others in the hall. Near as many lowered their cups or turned them upside down as Ball had done. Dunk's own cup was heavy in his hand. "How many eyes does Lord Bloodraven have?" the riddle went. "A thousand eyes and one." Toast followed toast, some proposed by Lord Frey and some by others. They drank to young Lord Tully, Lord Butterwell's liege lord, who had begged off from the wedding. They drank to the health of Leo Longthorn, Lord of Highgarden, who was rumored to be ailing. They drank to the memory of their gallant dead. "Aye," thought Dunk, remembering, "I'll gladly drink to them." Sir John the Fiddler proposed the final toast.
"To my brave brothers, I know that they are smiling tonight."
Dunk had not intended to drink so much with the jousting on the morrow,
but the cups were filled anew after every toast, and he found he had a thirst.
"Never refuse a cup of wine or a horn of ale," Ser Arlen had once told him. "It may be a year before you see another."